accession number 27741, Reel 1.
So this is Reel 1, the Reverend Michael LePage.
Yep, Laird.
Right. Can you tell me when you were born and where you were born?
Well, I was born in Dorset, near Shaftesbury, in the North Dorset, because my mother at that time was living with her parents, her husband, my dad, being in Nigeria at the time in the political service, and 1923, and I'm the youngest of three. My brother, who was 6 years older, was in the army during the war and in the artillery, and he saw service in Burma against the Japs in the jungle and got the MC for that. My sister, sadly, although she started the war as a VAD, a voluntary aid department nurse, she caught meningitis and died in 1940. There was a bit of sadness in the family there. But
what kind of what social background was what were your family?
Well, my grandpa was a vicar of a small parish just outside Shaftesbury, so we had contact with all the villagers, and we grew up in the 1920s. There weren't no luxuries in those days. When I was five, we moved to Salisbury when my dad came home from Nigeria, and I went to a prep school in Salisbury, Chaffin Grove, which was took us, both my brother and myself, and my sister went to the renowned Godolphin School, also as a day girl, and we enjoyed life there. It was we had good friends all around, but I was only, 7, 8, 9 at that time. Then Dad got a curacy at Warminster. We moved there for 3 years, and Christchurch, Warminster. I still have friends there. And then finally to Southwest Dorset, near Lyme Regis, where he became rector of a small parish near Charmouth.
And you followed, you didn't go to boarding school, you stayed with the
family? Yes, no, I went to boarding school after they moved to Warminster and then to Dorset. I went to a school near Bath called Monkton Coombe Secondary School, independent school, having got a special grant for being clergy son, and also took an exam which helped the coffers. I think the fees were £120 a year in those days. That was 1937.
And I mean, what were your hobbies? What kind of things did you like? Was there anything that you know, made you...
Oh, well, I was an outdoor boy. I used to love roaming around the country. We lived in the country all the time, and I used to love roaming the woods and the fields, and with a cousin who stayed with us in the holidays. We got up to all sorts of mischief. But, bird watching I was always involved in. And then when I got to school at Monkton Coombe, I took up rowing because... that was my great desire, Dad having been a rower and oarsman at Cambridge. And I did some rowing at school and laid a good foundation. What other hobbies? I don't know, natural history. But the war came, of course, 1939, only 2 years after that. And
what did you do in the period between leaving school and going?
Oh, nothing. I went straight into the Navy when I left school.
So was this always an intention? This is something you knew that you would do, or was it because the war was coming and there was a feeling in the country that you had to join up?
Yeah, so I don't know what I would have done if the war hadn't come. I think I was sort of thinking of being a teacher, which I did eventually become. But when the war came in 39, I was only 15, I suppose, or 16. My brother came to visit me. He joined the engineer straight away and got a commission because he'd be a territorial army. Oh, he says, it'll all be over before you leave school, which was not quite true. So I decided, because my uncle and godfather had both been in the Navy, and I wanted to be join the Navy. But I also wanted to fly, so I just...
But why did you want to fly? What had provoked that interest? You saw a plane for the first time when you were
eight? Yes, I suppose I'd read all the Biggles books, and I don't know, I was keen on doing something exciting, I suppose, at that age, one does. And so I put the two together in a very sort of ingenuous way, and thought, well, okay, let's join the Fleet Air Arm. It happened to coincide with the time when American planes were just being provided by Lease Lend, and they were shouting out for pilots right, left and centre, and coming calling in. So I had little difficulty, really, in getting into the Fleet Air Arm.
So you were at school for the first 2 years of the war?
Yeah.
During that time at school, did you belong to the... Was there a cadet
corps? Oh, yes, the school cadet force, which was army-orientated, of course, but we used to go to camps at Bisley and various places, and I had a lot of field training. But
and it was in earnest. You knew that probably, after Dunkirk, you would have thought...
Oh, yes, but this was 37, 38, 39, you see, before the war.
Right. Sorry,
first couple of years. It's all right. First couple of years, we were just doing it. In fact, we were still wearing putties, and based on the First World War style. Ghastly business, because when the war did come and we had to... We all joined the Dad's Army, you know, as the young volunteer in a pike. When we did have an emergency in the middle of the night, we had to get up and get dressed, and winding putties round your knee legs in the middle of the night. Oh, ghastly. Unfortunately, we got battle dress after about a year, I think. But I also applied through something called the Royal Naval Youth Entry, RNYE, to join the Navy, so as to make sure that I did get into the Navy and not drafted into the...
And what age was... What was the earliest you could join up?
Oh, 18, I think, in those days. Yes, but I was still... I was 17 when I applied like this and went for an interview in Bristol.
What year was that? Sorry,
this would have been 1941, I suppose.
41, right. So there was a... I mean, you were still at school then when Dunkirk...
Oh, yes, yes.
So what was the feeling? I mean, was there a patriotic sense of feeling amongst the school that, you know, this, as soon as I must get out, I must join up, I must...
Well, amongst some, yes. There were some who really were, what should we say, military or army orientated. We had a special branch of the local Home Guard who did quite a bit of secret work on something called the Green Line round Bath. They all went straight into the army. I can't say. I think most of the rest of us were so keen on getting our academic stuff done and sports and so on, the usual life of a school, that we didn't really think too much about the war. The usual privations in the food line, of course, that probably affected us more than the wider scene.
Did you actually experience any physical evidence of the war? Were there
dog fights over the
school?
They had the Baedeker raid on Bath just before the beginning of one of these autumn terms. Was it 1940 or 41? And this disrupted all the supplies of gas and electricity and everything. In fact, we got a week deferred. We couldn't go back for about a week or two after that.
What happened?
They Exeter had it too. They bombed two raids, I think, two night raids, just a sort of nuisance raids, really, because there was no military objective. Well, the Admiralty were somewhere near Bath, but I don't think that's really what they were after. It was just a nuisance raid on the population. And it affected our supplies and things, but we were already so strapped for food and supplies and things that it didn't... We just rather laughed it off.
Can you bring the mic a bit closer? That's right.
Sure. I'll take my specs off because they're...
Yeah, whatever.
Getting in the way.
And so we come now, you're 17, and you join this early entry scheme.
Yeah.
Tell me a bit about that.
Well, it didn't really... I went on with the cadet force combined cadet force in the school. I think I was company sergeant major, I can't remember, but so I was getting used to giving orders and shouting. Not really my line. But we did a very interesting course at Dartmouth in 1941 and met a sort of introduction to the Navy, and I enjoyed that very much. We did some some boating on the Dart, and of course a lot of introduction to ASDIC and all the things that were coming into operation, and made some good friends.
How long was that?
Oh, it was only a couple of weeks, I think. But I still have memories of that for some reason.
And you stayed in the.
Yes, we messed in the with the midshipmen and in the hall there. I can still remember some of the one called Sexsmith, sitting at the end of the table. We were all very green. But it was an interesting experience.
Were you in awe of these people, you know, the way at that age?
No, not really. Well, a certain amount, but they weren't much older than us. I mean, midshipmen in the Navy at that time, probably about the same age, you know. We were all organized in watches and so on. And the Dartmouth had a bomb attack on it a few months before, and we had a barrage balloon, I remember, floating from the harbor. But nothing very exciting happened while we were there. But that was the introduction to the Navy. And then I joined up in... They fortunately let me stay till the end of the academic year, July 42. And I was still rowing hard. But then I joined up in September of that year.
And so you got your school certificate and...
Oh, I got that 2 years before, yes. I was doing higher certificate then.
Oh, higher, sorry, yeah.
Well, school certificate was the qualification for Fleet Air Arm entry. You had to, because it involved quite a lot of maths and navigation skills. When we did start flying, we had to have a Dalton computer strapped to the knee, and you had to work out your track and wind and course by twiddling knobs and doing a bit of maths. So there had to be a bit of basic maths for the training.
But you'd done your higher, so you could have gone on to university if you'd wished.
Yes, the idea was to get a place at the university so that I could come back to it after the war, which I was fortunate to be able to do.
Father's University?
Sorry?
Was it your father's university?
It was, and his same college, yes, Selwyn College, Cambridge, and my brother, and an uncle. So nice. Didn't have much choice, really.
Well, tell me about the induction then. You were accepted as soon as you were old enough. You went in. Is that right?
That's right. Yes, I was accepted by the Lords of the Admiralty in Bristol, and then got my call up papers to join up at Leon Solent, which HMS Daedalus was the headquarters of the Fleet Air Arm in those days.
How did you feel about when you were? You were accepted and you went.
Oh, it was very exciting. I mean, we were doing what everybody else was doing by then. And
A letter came through the post? How did it happen?
Yes, I can't remember now. Yes, I think that must have been it. And we travelled along to Leon Solent and were handed out. I think I've got something in my diary about the way we were received and handed out our uniform, stamped with our rubber stamped name on all the bits, square rig, of course, and a hat.
I don't understand a square rig.
Square rig is the sailor's uniform. I've still got my collar somewhere.
I see.
So we were ratings, bottom of the ladder. And the only thing we did have, because we were prospective air crew, we had a white band around the hat, which were prospective officers, I think, or something. I don't know what, because we didn't all become officers, but the minimum rank for a pilot was sergeant or in the RAF, and chief petty officer in the Navy. But most of the crew, when we'd finished our training in Canada, as we moved up to leading airman, same as leading hand, which is like a corporal in the army. At the end of that time, we were commissioned in Canada.
Mm. Oh, I see. Well, we're jumping ahead a bit, but it's
yes.
That's all right. Let's go. So, HMS Daedalus.
Daedalus.
What was it? What was it? It was a shore-based.
Oh, just a barrack. Yes, a huge barrack square, which we did a month's square bashing and instructed in survival techniques. Personal, close to what's it called? Close combat, which was all totally new to us, of course, and we'd all been brought up with a very English attitude towards other people. You know, you respect other people, but we had to be taught to hate the Germans, which was not easy, even for us at that stage. We slept in a barrack room. I think there were about 20 or 30 of us in this long, great long rows and rows of double beds all the way down the barrack room. I could say at that stage it wasn't easy to be a Christian in that environment, because I had been brought up in a vicarage. The language was one thing, of course. Most of the others only had one adjective, which you can guess what it was, or perhaps two, one B and the other F. But so I had to learn a few things there. But I found one or two others in the dormitory who shared the same attitudes as I did, and we began to meet together to redress the balance.
In what way? I mean,
we had small meetings in the evening when we were in spare time, able to share have a Bible study together, and there were chaplain. I think there was a chaplain there. I don't remember meeting him, but we tried to encourage each other to stand up against the.
Were you at all victimized? Were you seen as toffs, or were the majority of the other ratings working class guys?
No. We were all post school certificate,
course,
you
yeah,
see.
Right.
So, no, we didn't meet the very rough characters, but many of them came from backgrounds which we hadn't shared, I mean, grammar schools and so on. But they were a good bunch on the whole. I made good friends there and kept up with some until quite recently. I rather lost touch lately.
So you've done your month's square bashing.
Yeah.
And there's an element of flying training in that, or?
No, nothing at all. Just
no
square bashing, just licking us into shape.
And was it really brutal, or was it? Could you survive it?
Oh no, it was all right. It was good, tough going, but I'd been used to it in the CCF, that sort of background. I mean, treatment. We had. I remember one petty officer who was particularly, I wouldn't say brutal exactly, but he was a bit rough. And I can remember him coming in one day. We'd been doing weapon training, grenades and so on. He said, "Well, you know, he had a grenade in his hand." Which we thought was might have been live. He said, "You know what I've told you to do, and if I pull out the pin and let go of this and drop it on the floor, what do you do?" Because we all went flat on the floor with our heads over the. But it was obviously only a dummy.
Got for that. So you finished your training.
Well, finished that month. Then we went on to Lyons, to Gosport, to a ship. Shore establishment called HMS St. Vincent. That was a bit of a byword in rough living. The kitchens had to be seen to be believed. I mean, they just wouldn't be tolerated anywhere today. The cockroaches on the walls used to turn up in the cabbage, and on the the cabbage was a sort of pale, wishy-washy grey stuff, and the plum duff came on the table. You could hardly get your fork into it. But we survived, and again, we were in a great big dormitory.
And there was a feeling of bonhomie, everyone was comfortable because it was wartime.
Yes.
Who were angry and who were resentful saying what they were.
No. I mean, because we were motivated, we knew what was coming, and we were motivated to towards that end of becoming, we were all looking forward to the day we could start flying. We had this 2 months at Gosport, learning seamanship mostly, ship recognition. Morse and semaphore, which I knew already from scouting days, knotting and recognition, ship recognition, aircraft recognition were the big things, because you had to know what you were doing then, and weapon training.
What kind of weapons did you train on?
Oh, just the ordinary rifle, 303, I think they were. But we were all looking forward to the days when we could start flying, which was only a couple of months away. And for that we went to, some went to Elmden near Birmingham, which I think is now probably the Birmingham International Airport. Others of us went to somewhere near Chester called Sealand, and that's where we started flying on Tiger Moths.
When was the decision made, or that you would be a pilot and you might be a navigation officer? When was that? I mean, how early on was it obvious that you were going to be pilots? Immediately after the month's square bashing in Daedalus? Or?
No, I think it was after St. Vincent, I think. I mean, I'd put down for pilot very early on, and I think most of us would have. The thing was that there were certain standards you had to pass, a pass rate, at each level all along the way. And if you didn't make the grade at that stage, you were sidetracked into another line. And observers didn't have to train, obviously, to fly, because they were sitting in the back of an Avenger or some aircraft doing the mapping and doing the navigation. But I forget exactly when the decision was made, but I had opted for pilot right from the beginning.
So there must have been an element of tension. I mean, if you have all these tests all the time, you must be worried.
Oh, yes. Oh, indeed.
You know, studying your books.
Yes. Oh, it was pretty high pressure all the time. And we kept each other up to it, you know. And before, we had written tests every now and then on meteorology. We had to study weather and all the map charts. We discovered, obviously, cartography, and I think I've still got things in my notebook over there, some of the things we studied. But all these things, with the written tests, we used to test each other before the exam. Oh, internal combustion engine. I remember being taught the workings of induction, compression, was it suck, push, bang, blow? I've forgotten.
Well, except you might get in Marseille.
Yes. And gunnery, too. We had to learn a little bit about guns. You had to know a little about everything, really.
What did you find the most challenging?
Well, now you're asking. I don't remember back as far as that. Map reading I loved. I enjoyed map reading, so that was no problem. I went solo in 8 hours, I think, after 8 hours flying the Tiger Moth, so that wasn't too much of a bother. But no, later on, it was the deck landings,
I think. Oh, yeah, right. No,
but
no,
we won't come on to that now.
Yeah, I meant in the business of the tests, you know. Yes. Most of the trainees were found most intimidating was what, the maths or the...
Yes, I think a lot... Well, it depended on their background, you know. Mm-hmm. Some were better at maths than others. I don't think I had too much difficulty because, I say, the sort of basic standard was school cert, mm-hmm. although I'd gone ahead beyond that in classics, and that wasn't much help. Sure. Latin and Greek. But I always liked languages. But again, that wasn't any good. It was mainly navigation and the old Dalton computer.
So you're notified. Lepage, you're going to be a pilot. So
yep.
There's a jubilation. Your parents are
happy.
Yes. Can you talk a bit about that?
Well,
when you actually learned that you'd got through the.
Yes, I don't know how jubilant my parents were because at that stage the shadow over the Fleet Air Arm was still from Scharnhorst and Gneisenau and the old Swordfish being the front line aircraft, which of course were sitting targets for the German gunners, and they
Sorry,
hadn't.
I don't know that story. Can you?
Scharnhorst and Gneisenau were two German first frontline warship
battleships.
Yes,
right.
And they got holed up in Brest. We had control of the seas, apart from the submarines, of course, which wrought havoc in the Atlantic at the time. Come on to that in a minute, but when they made a dash for it from Brest to get through to Kiel Canal, or somewhere or up there.
Yeah.
They managed to get quite a long way before they were spotted. And then the last minute, the Swordfish of the Fleet Air Arm went in with their torpedoes to try and get them. But of course, a Swordfish, being the old first Biggles type biplane, had to fly straight and level just over the water to be able to drop the torpedo effectively. And they were just hitting targets for the, I think only about three or four got back out of the whole squadron. They were all shot down. And that gave the Fleet Air Arm an aura of danger, which was by the time I got operational, I was flying much more modern aircraft.
But this was hanging over you. You knew this was...
Well, I didn't know it too much. No, I'm sure my parents did, or they had been warned, or other people in the village where I lived knew. And
do you remember going back on leave and everyone saying, "Oh, you're going to be a pilot for wonderful"?
Yes, no, I don't know. I didn't try not to bask in too much undeserved glory. At that stage, I was only a very, very raw pilot.
So
a rookie.
A rookie rating. So, yeah. But so you go on now to the training, the first
elementary flying training,
yeah.
EFTS.
So
yes.
Can you tell me about your first encounter with an aircraft, with the Tiger Moth?
The Tiger Moth. Well, we went.
How it happened?
Sealand was the name of the airstrip. Just outside Chester, and as far as I remember, we went up by train, it was quite a different. It was a step up in the world because air crew, as we were starting to fly, were given better food. We had slightly better conditions. We were still in a dormitory with long rows and rows of beds, but they were single bunks this time instead of doubles. And we were taken out and introduced to the cockpit and explained how to control the Tiger Moth. It's a marvelous little aircraft, 80 horsepower, DH-87A, and responded very easily. The pilot sat, the two pilots, I mean the instructor, sat in front as far as I remember, and the, or was it the other way around? No, I can't remember. And the pupil behind, connected by intercommunication, just a voice pipe. You know, there was no radio in those days, and you didn't need it anyway, just for elementary flying, because at the beginning one had to do circuits and bumps, they were called, over and over and over again until you got the idea of a three-point landing. We also had to do a certain amount of throwing the aircraft about. And particularly how to get out of a spin. A spin is when the aircraft loses airway and one wing drops and then you start going down like a leaf because there's not enough forward motion, so you have to know the right action to get out of that. Otherwise, you just go straight in. That's what happened in the end of the First World War. A lot of aircraft were lost and pilots because they didn't know how to get out of the spin.
And how do you get out of a spin?
Well, you put on opposite rudder, put the throttle full forward, and try to get the nose down. You're actually not pointing it downward. You're floating with the nose still up in the air a bit.
How much a ground instruction was given before you went up for the first time?
Oh, ask me another. I can't remember now.
All right, okay.
But it was half and half. I mean, one half of the day was spent in flying with the instructor, and the other half probably in classroom instruction. But heavens, it's 50, 60 years ago now.
Okay, no. I'm just trying to get the idea of the way that you were introduced to the cockpit, to the way that you were, you know, what the rudder did, what the stick did,
and so forth. Well, I mean, I think that was fairly self-explanatory. I mean, you just got in and had to dress up in goggles and inner suit, a very padded suit inside, great big boots. I've still got the boots, sheepskin, gloves, goggles, helmet. Because it's all open cockpit, there's no cover there, and this was January 1940, 43 this would have been, January, which was quite cold.
January 43, as late as that.
Yeah, I joined up in 42, September 42. We had the 3-month square preparation, and then January went up to Sealand.